Genealogy by Tim, Season 6, Episode 5, recorded May 30th, 2026. I'm Tim. The website is genealogybytim.com. The email address is tim@genealogybytim.com. And another month has gone by. It's time for a new podcast. This month, more progress on PALS. I let you know what I've done in the last month in furtherance of completing my PALS application. And also, new cousins. Frank Straup, the treasurer of the Genealogical Society of Pennsylvania, discovered last month that I am his wife's fourth cousin once removed, and if they have any children, then I guess they would be my fifth cousins. More research on this line may unravel the mysteries of the Smith family's staggered immigration to the United States. I'll tell you all about that coming up on Genealogy by Tim. Last month on the podcast, I told you about the progress I've made completing my application for the Pennsylvania Ancestors Lineage Society. I told you about how I ordered the death certificates of my paternal grandparents and great-grandmother. I told you about how I filled in the new landscape-oriented application. The work continued this month as I paid careful attention to the checklist for preparing and submitting an application to the Pennsylvania Ancestors Lineage Society. This checklist is available on the Genealogical Society of Pennsylvania's website, and it's to be completed and submitted along with the application. For those new to the podcast, I am trying to prove that I'm descended from Nicholas Hogendobler, who emigrated to the United States from Switzerland in 1750, because it wasn't the United States at that time, it was the colonies then. And so I must meticulously document 10 generations of ancestors, put all the information in this application, provide supporting documents in a way that's easy for others to understand and follow my trail of evidence. And in the process of doing that, the Genealogical Society of Pennsylvania has us applicants complete a checklist just to keep us on a straight and narrow, make sure we're doing things the way they expect them to be done. I'll link to the checklist in the show notes so you can follow along if you like. Last month I was working on the first four checks of the checklist. Use reliable evidence from primary sources, such as government-issued vital records. To fulfill that check, I swapped out some newspaper obituaries, some online funeral home obituaries, for the actual government-issued vital records. That would be for my paternal grandparents and my paternal grandmother's mother. Also, not used county or church histories. This is from the checklist. Printed family histories, pedigree charts, family tree charts, family group sheets, lineage books, or other sources unless they are supported by reliable, contemporary, acceptable sources. So, I had among my sources in the first iteration of this application the Biographical Annals of Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. I've since taken that out of my sources list and instead either relied on other sources where necessary, or if unnecessary, I simply dropped the information from the application. And I also documented complete information as appropriate for at least the first three most recent generations. And that was the purpose of ordering the death certificates. And then it says, after that, I have documented at least a birth date and place or a death date and place for each identified person in each generation. Now, that one's going to be tough because the only real source of Catherine Hogentogler's birthday, or birth date, I should say, is from her gravestone monument at Silver Spring Cemetery in West Hempfield Township, Lancaster County. And that's really too weathered to photograph legibly, but if you go to it, you can barely kind of make it out with your own eyes. Other than that, I believe I fulfilled that check of the checklist last month as I was compiling my documents. This month, I spent many hours during Memorial Day weekend. I was on the computer, hours at a time, each day of that weekend, making more modifications to the document in order to satisfy some of the checks of this checklist. One thing they ask for in the checklist is that applicants include a title page and or publication page for all published works. So that means if I'm getting my information from a book, they want me to include not only the page with the information, they also want the title page so that the reviewers who are reviewing these applications know where I got that information, from what book, from what publication. So I spent a lot of time adding those title pages. And when I originally went out to Lancaster, went to the Lancaster History Museum and Research Center, sometimes I photographed the title page of the book, but a lot of times I photographed the outside of the book, the spine of the book, where the call number is, and also the front of the book where the title is. So I hope that that is satisfactory, and it should help the reviewers identify the source material. So after having added all of those title pages and cover photographs, my word processor file full of documents now boasts 45 separate documents spread across 72 pages. So this is going to be quite a large application, and for that purpose, I have arranged all these documents in a binder so that they'll be easy for the reviewers to flip back and forth, find the information that I'm using to support the claims I made on my application. Now, a word about the binder. I've decided to switch formats from standard 8.5x11 letter paper to 8.5x14 legal paper for these documents. And the reason I made that switch is that one of the checklist items asks that I check that every copy of each document is legible and clearly proves what I'm saying it proves. I was concerned that the 8.5x11 paper was too small to contain both the citations that I wanted to put and a copy of several of these documents. The originals often come on 8.5x11 paper. Some of them come on legal paper themselves, so trying to cram the citation and a copy of the document onto an 8.5x11 sheet of paper. Some of these documents were getting kind of small, getting kind of tiny, and I thought to enhance the legibility of these documents, I thought, well, let's use 8.5x14 legal paper so that some of these documents can be reproduced in nearly their original size and they can have a nice full citation above, all on the same paper. Now, it doesn't say anything here in the checklist about what size paper you should use, so I'm hoping this is okay. And one thing I discovered in the process of buying the new binder for my 8.5x14, I discovered there are not so many choices once you stray away from standard letter size 8.5x11 paper. I was looking high and low for a half-inch ring 8.5x14 binder. I could not find one. But I did find a 1-inch ring 8.5x14 binder. So that's going to have to do. It's going to be a little thicker than I think I need it to be, but it'll have to do. And the price was something else, too. I mean, you can get binders pretty cheap, 8.5x11, but these 8.5x14 binders are like $20. There's nothing really special about them either, other than their size. And then the dividers are another story. So, like, I have a few different sections. I have a application section, I have a document section, and then the appendix where I'm proving descendancy through land records. That's a separate section. In my first version of this application, I had those separated by 3-ring dividers. And those, of course, are 8.5x11. If you go on Amazon and look for 8.5x14 dividers, your choices are limited. And they're going to take weeks to get here. So it's weird. Once you get out of, you know, the comfort zone of 8.5x11 paper, things get expensive, things get rare, things take a long time to ship. So patience is necessary here for this project, but I think it's going to be worth the extra time and money. In addition to adding the cover pages, title pages, and changing the format to 8.5x14, I also spent a lot of time editing the documents themselves in a image editor to add arrows and underlines to the pertinent information. It's one of the checklist items. It says, check to make sure that you have underlined the pertinent portions of the documents in red or placed arrows in the margins to draw attention to them. I have not used highlighters. And surely the people who wrote this checklist would be satisfied if I simply used a pen and drew arrows and underlines on the documents. I went ahead and added these digitally to the image files because that would make it easier for me if I wanted to reproduce a paper or maybe make a second copy of the binder for myself, maybe quickly correct an error and reprint one of the sheets, and I don't have to go run around looking for a red pen to redraw all my arrows. They are where they need to be in the digital file, reproducible. But one thing I'm a little concerned about is the instruction here that says I have not used highlighters. Now, I didn't take one of those marker highlighters, but what I did do on many of my documents is I digitally highlighted some pertinent information. So when I run my application by one of the reviewers, are they going to say that that was sort of a violation of the highlight guideline? I mean, I didn't actually use a highlighter, but I did highlight things by other means. So that was all like in the process of doing all the image editing. I was like, oh, this will look cool. I'll just, you know, highlight this portion. And then I went over and read the checklist and it says, do not use highlighters. So I was like, I wonder, but we'll see. They're easy enough to remove, but it'll take a little more time on the computer. Another month, but we'll see. We'll see how that turns out. So another thing I spent a lot of time doing this month is updating the source and citation information. You know, as I said earlier, I switched to 8.5x14 paper, so there would be a nice area at the top of the page for me to write my citations, and then below the citations will be a full-size area where I am reproducing the documents. The checklist item says, check to make sure you have written a complete source citation on the front of each page of each document. If retrieved from an online source, that source is clearly noted. If there's no space on the front, the information can be written on the reverse of the page. I made room on the front by going with larger paper. And I did also, in addition to adding cover pages and title pages to the documents where necessary, I also added screenshots of Ancestry.com, FamilySearch.org, if I used a digital source. But I also wrote complete source citation information and also repository information. So not only did I say what is the name of the source, what is the name of the citation, but also where did I get that information. So if it came from a family member's stash of personal documents, I wrote the personal documents of this person and where that person lives. Or if I got the information from the Lancaster History Museum and Research Center, I put, you know, that Lancaster History Museum and Research Center along with the address of that institution. So there's a lot of, even if I ordered vital records from the state of Pennsylvania, I put repository, State of Pennsylvania, Department of Health, and the address where that document would be located. It's out in Newcastle, Pennsylvania. So really complete here with source citation and repository information on the front of each of these pages. And then lastly, what I did this month, there's a check on the checklist that says, used complete names as they appear in the submitted documents without any additions. Now that one for me is a little tricky because in a lot of places in his application, especially once you get in the Hogendoblers, they spell their names as many ways as there are stars in the sky. Some documents have the same guy's name spelled differently in two different places in the document. So I'll have to ask for a little bit of grace on this check. It says use complete names as they appear in the submitted documents without any additions, but if I did that, it would just be scattered names all over the application, all over my explanations. So what I did instead, and I hope this is okay with people, I identified one document that I felt was the best representation of this person's name, either the most common representation, if it's from a paper source, and on one source I used the gravestone because that's his name etched in stone. But I would add to, you know, source citation and reason for giving this document, I say add to the reason for giving it was this is the preferred representation of this person's name. So I selected a document. Wherever there was a possible conflict, I selected a document to represent the name, and I wrote clearly on there, this is the document I'm using to represent the name. Anywhere you see on this application the name written, I'm choosing this to be the official name, basically. And that's what I did last month, or I should say this month for this podcast, in furtherance of my pal's application. And so what's next? All right, I got my eyes on a few checkboxes here. One of these says, grouped all documents by generation, fastened each generation with a paperclip, no staples, and included the generation's number on each document. So I'm going to go through all my documents, all 45 of them, and put somewhere on the document what generation this refers to, so that the reviewer can easily flip back and forth between the application and the document in the binder. Now, I'm not using paper clips, and I hope that's okay. I hope they appreciate my organization here in the binder. But yes, add generation number. Okay, and it also says my name and address are on the reverse of every piece of paper submitted, so I'm going to add a footer to the document. It's basically going to have my name and address. That should be pretty easy. So you just put the footer, and it should appear at the bottom of every page. Another check mark that I need to put on my checklist says that I identified the documents that show the links between generations. So those documents get a special marking. So every document has what generation this document's referring to, but certain special documents actually show the link between one generation and another. So that's going to get a special marking there that says generations 1 to 2 link, or generations 5 to 6 link, something like that, whatever it is. So that's going to be done over the course of the next month. Also, cleaning up my sources citations. I don't know if I'll ever have that perfect, but I'll be working on that a lot next month, just making sure that those sources citations explanations all say what they ought to say. And then lastly, I want to mention this. One of the checks says that I included copies of original documents and photos with all transcriptions and translations. So one thing I did just a couple days ago was I have a document in here. It's a burial record from 1820, but it's written in German. And I thought it would be nice to have a professional go ahead and translate that and provide a certified translation that I can include among my documents. And that wasn't cheap, okay? But I thought it was worth it for this project. And the service I went with was Catherine Schober at Germanology Unlocked. That's germanologyunlocked.com. And I went with this service because she did a presentation. It was an online Zoom presentation for the Genealogical Society of Pennsylvania. And I was, you know, impressed with what she had to say. So I thought she'd make a good person to translate this document, put her seal of approval on it. Either her herself, or she does have some assistants who work for her. I'm sure they're all vetted and highly competent people, but I went with that service to translate the document and provide a certification, like, here, this is what this document says. Now, when using this service, one thing to understand is that they do have a timeline of about 3 months. So if you're considering using this service, just keep in mind the timeline. They can expedite the translation for a fee. So they have a rush tier where you can pay a little bit extra to have the translation done within 1 month instead of 3 months. And then they also have an expedited tier where you can have the translation done within 2 weeks. I went middle of the road. I went with the rush option because I would like to have this PALS application done by July so I can present it to the Genealogical Society of Pennsylvania in commemoration of America 250. So that I have family ancestors that go back to the American Revolution, and this is kind of what I'm doing to celebrate that. And then hopefully by June's podcast at the end of next month, I'll be able to say this is just about finished. It should probably be all printed and placed in the binders by then. I'm probably just doing some last-minute revisions and corrections at that point, but hopefully by the end of June, I'll be able to say, hey, I've got this thing just about done, and I'll let you know what's in it at that time. So I got one more story for you this month, and this one's actually kind of fun. Now, if you go to some regular genealogy club meetings, usually after some amount of time, a couple people at these meetings will say, hey, I guess we're related. Hey, cousins, all right. Because, we, you know, we all have Pennsylvania ancestors when we go to these meetings at the Genealogical Society of Pennsylvania. So it's not implausible that you go back 10 generations, you're going to find some common ancestors. And I've seen this happen 2 times, 3 times, 4 times. Hey, we're cousins, hey. And I always wondered, when am I going to meet a cousin here in this meeting? Well, guess what? That happened. At our last meeting, the treasurer, Frank Strop, is also the guy who organized the Second Saturday meetings. And he was doing some research on his wife on FamilySearch.org, on the family tree. And he went back several generations and he started seeing a familiar name editing the family search tree. And that name would be my name. It was Genealogy by Tim. That's my username on Family Search. So Frank saw that and he thought, wait a minute, am I related to Tim? And he brought that question up at our last meeting. And I was like, I'm not sure, because I did a lot of work on there. And some of it was just like separating out families that were all merged together. So, you know, I end up doing a lot of work on people who aren't actually related to me. If it furthers the clarity of people who are related to me, just to sort of separate them out or whatever. So I said, I'm not sure. Let me look into it. So I did look into it. And guess what? I am related to Frank Strop's wife, and I'm going to talk to him about his family. So he didn't tell me his wife's name. Or he didn't tell me if he has any children. But his wife would be my fourth cousin once removed. His children would be my fifth cousins. And it's interesting because we're not going back to Pennsylvania ancestors. We're going back to Ireland for this one. All the way back to Thomas Tierney and Margaret Connor, who were born in 1815 and 1816, respectively. They had several children, but there's three of them who are central to this story. The eldest daughter, Bridget Tierney, she is Mrs. Strop's ancestor. The second daughter, Maria Tierney, is my ancestor. And then there's also an Anna Tierney who enters the mix, and I'll tell you about that in a little bit. But first, the families. Thomas Tierney and Margaret Connor had their first daughter, Bridget Tierney, in 1845. She married a Thomas Callahan in Ireland. They had a daughter, Margaret Callahan, who moved to America on her own, and once here, she married a man named William Litchin. Margaret was born in 1875, died in 1943. William Litchin was born in 1870 and died in 1906. He died of a railroad accident. And that seems to be a pattern in his family, as you'll see. Margaret and Thomas's other daughter, Maria Tierney, was born in 1846. I'm not quite sure when she died. She married James R. Smith in Ireland. And this is where the mystery happens. I referred to this in the opening, that there's kind of a mystery here. I'm not quite sure what happened, because my great-great-grandfather was a son of James Smith and Maria Tierney. For some reason or other, James Smith and Maria Tierney came to America, but they left poor William behind. I'm not sure why they did that. James Smith and Maria Tierney came to America in 1857 and settled in Boston. Their son, my great-great-grandfather, William Smith, who was born in 1870. He came to America in 1892, and he settled in Philadelphia. And I always wondered, like, why did this happen with his family? Why do you have parents going to America, leaving a child behind? Parents go to Boston. Parents have more children in Boston. Okay, and then their son comes over to America later and settles in Philadelphia. Now enter this other daughter, Anna Tierney, who married a John Cosgrove. Now, I'm not sure if they got married in Ireland or if they got married in Philadelphia, but they eventually settled in Philadelphia. Okay, so you have Thomas Tierney and Margaret Connor. They are the common ancestors, okay? You have Anna Tierney is a daughter of theirs, married John Cosgrove. They moved to Philadelphia. You have James R. Smith and Maria Tierney, my great-great-great-grandparents, moved to Boston. You have Bridget Tierney and Thomas Callahan. They have that daughter, Margaret Callahan. And here's where it all comes together. On Margaret's passenger list, it says that she's going to an aunt, Anne Cosgrove. And it gives the address, 4744 Marion Street. So initially, we weren't even sure if Anna Tierney was a daughter of Thomas Tierney and Margaret Connor. But since this passenger list identified her as the aunt of Margaret Callahan, I think we can reasonably assume that she is another daughter of Thomas Tierney and Margaret Connor, sister to Bridget Tierney and Maria Tierney. Of course, that's not 100% proven, because some people use the term aunt to mean a few different things, but I think we have probable cause, I guess you'd say, to believe that Bridget, Maria, and Anna Tierney were sisters. Bridget stayed in Ireland. Maria married James Smith, moved to Boston. Anna Tierney and John Cosgrove lived in Philadelphia. Margaret Callahan, daughter of Bridget, when she came to America, it said on her passenger list that she's going to stay with her aunt, Anna Cosgrove, at 4744 Marion Street. So I thought, you know, I wonder if I could find my great-great-grandfather's passenger list this way. I hadn't looked for it. I was just too intimidated by the name William Smith. There's got to be a zillion William Smiths. But I said, maybe we have a little more information here about where he ended up in Philadelphia. So I used Family Search, used the full text to look through some of the passenger lists for 1892, and I found one. Don't ask me how I found it, but I found it, and I've saved it right to that family tree, and now I can come back to it whenever I want. But it said William Smith, WM, abbreviated William Smith, and then it says in the last column, PPD, not sure what that means, passage paid maybe, or whatever. But it says, to Aunt, 4644 Marion Avenue. Now, like I said earlier in the podcast, 4744, but the correct address is 4644. But in any case, that uniquely identifies my great-great-grandfather, William Smith. And it looks like both William Smith and Margaret Callahan went from Ireland. They were cousins, and they both went from Ireland to stay with their Aunt Anna Cosgrove. So I'm not sure if they ever sort of lived together with Anna, or if, you know, Margaret came and left and then William came and left. I don't know if they lived at the same time, but that's a link between my great-great-grandfather and Mrs. Strop's ancestor, Margaret Callahan, is that they both seem to have lived under the roof of their Aunt Anna Tierney and her husband, John Cosgrove. Now, if you were able to follow all that, you are better than I. I would have gotten lost in the sauce there. I was just kind of excited about this whole story and just wanted to, you know, as briefly as possible, just give all the names and the relationships there. But I can't wait to get back to the meeting next month and tell Frank what I discovered here and see if he has any more information. So we kind of have kind of a narrative of how William Smith, my great-great-grandfather, ended up in Philadelphia. Still not quite sure why James Smith and Maria Tierney, those are William's parents, I'm not quite sure why they went to Boston. But interestingly, they both died in Boston before William Smith, my great-great-grandfather, came to America. So he wouldn't have gone to live with his parents. He does have siblings in Boston, but he chose instead to come to Philadelphia with his aunt, Anna Cosgrove. And maybe, you know, we'll do some more research and maybe we'll come up with some more information about this family, you know, see what the Boston connection is. But I just thought that was interesting. I thought I'd share that. All right, folks, that's just about it for this month. We've got two very interesting developing stories for you. I will have more on each of those, I'm sure, next month. I should be closer to having a complete binder containing a Pennsylvania Ancestors Lineage Society application, and I will have met with Frank once again to discuss our Tierney relatives. Until then, my friends, I've been Tim. Genealogybytim.com is the website. Tim@genealogybytim.com is the email address. Keep on digging. Your next family history adventure awaits. wait. I don't know about that. All right, we'll make accommodations. All right.